had sent a fucking love letter to my house. Just call me, dude.
Here, Alex said, handing me the letter. I took my time, reader. I took my sweet damn time wading through that boring-ass letter, and on page 2, I finally got to the portion of the program that sparked this scene. "I've just got to say," Keith wrote, "the fellatio this weekend was very good." I nodded a double confirmation, one for Alex, now knowing I was cheating, and one for Keith being corny enough to say fellatio. I will say, however, that wanting to be caught cheating is different from having the specifics in print. So I just put on my game face. "What is that?" Alex said, in a dramatic tearing-me-apart voice. I paused. "It is what it is." Nailed it. You know when you say shit and you think, ooh, that was good? I was really impressed with myself. Alex was just incredulous and looked like he was about to cry. "Did you suck his dick, Nick?" Look, I don't know if it was the Seussian title of "Did you suck his dick, Nick?" or the stress of the situation, but I just fell out into a lean-on-a-chair fit of laugh-crying. "I did." More laughter. "I did. What more proof do you need? Yes, fellatio, I did." This had to be it, right? It was over now. Nope. "I can't live without you," he said. "We can work this out."
Record scratch.
"You said you would leave if I cheated," I said, holding back what I wanted to say. "A deal is a fucking deal. Get out." He started singing "Nobody Knows" by the Tony Rich Project. Why didn't I say the things I needed to say? How could I let my angel get away? "You need your space to heal," I yelled, cutting him off before the chorus. "I don't deserve you. Go!" Alex left, and then everything went radio silent. I'd gotten what I'd wanted, shoop shoop. But then I was stuck with Keith. He came to black graduation at UCLA, officially called the African graduation ceremony since it started in 1979. In front of all my cool friends, he gave me a crystal vase as a present. He was suddenly grandpa to them. They were all taking pictures with it, putting the vase on their heads, pretending to drink booze from it. Then he corrected my grammar. Like the time I said, "I think it would be funner to just do that." "Funner? Is that a word?" he said. "Did you just make that up?" So that ended that, just about the time I found out that Alex had fucked one of my best friends and was also dating a model and a Janet Jackson dancer. I was stuck with Crystal Vaz Grammar Cop, and he had upgraded to a backup dancer. Hell no. What if Alex was the one and I screwed it up because I was chasing a cornball? What if nobody ever loves me again? So I became obsessed with what he was doing. Everything he was doing. I went back to the grief side of Exhale, with only Whitney's halting, breathy voice to help. "Yes. Why does it hurt so bad, Whitney?" "If you're in the crazy hurt passage of heartbreak, let's go on this ride together, shall we?" One night, I decided it made perfect sense to put on all black clothing and a black knit cap and borrow my friend's car. I drove to Alex's apartment where he now lived with his old college teammate. I closed the car door softly and skulked my scully-hatted ass into his bushes so I could look in his window. I just wanted to see his face. I wanted to know who he was with. This seemed perfectly rational. There were no lights on, so when I got to the window, I could see myself reflected in the glass. I looked at my eyes, shining brightly at me. "You are officially the psycho bitch," I said. "I'm not supposed to be in the bushes looking in someone's window." So I slowly, ever so slowly, crept back to the car like a hapless cat burglar coming up empty-handed. I could have avoided all this if I had just watched Angela Bassett in Waiting to Exhale. Angela, plays Bernadine, who sets her husband's car ablaze, lamenting all the time she put him first, making herself the background to his foreground. She didn't pay for his beauty school, but she did become his secretary. It's the scene that created the term Angela Bassett moment, an epic declaration of self-worth that I wanted for my mother and for everyone who realizes they got played. As I watch, I start screaming, and I can do every word. But the worst. Oh, the fucking worst, she says, ripping his clothes out of his closet only to later light the cigarette that will set them and his car ablaze. The worst thing is that he made me move out here where my children are in school with only one other black kid so they won't be improperly influenced. Well, guess what, John? You're the motherfucking improper influence. Get your shit, and get out. It's the moment where you reclaim your sanity by going insane. The burst of clarity that comes with blind rage. So, let Angela have it for you. Breathe in the smoke from the car and move on with her out of the bushes. In retrospect, I can say to myself, are you kidding me? Why would you lose it over that freaking loser? But I know it doesn't ever feel like that in the moment. It feels reasonable to be in all black wearing a Scully as you crouch in someone's bushes. Absolutely fucking reasonable. Pro tip. Give yourself the full Tina Turner experience. What's Love Got to Do with It is, of course, based on Tina Turner's memoir, I, Tina. After my Greek-Mexican beauty school dropout, I went into full Tina immersion. I watched the movie, I read the book, and I had that film soundtrack on repeat. If she'd put out a Tina Crunch cereal, I would have had it every morning. I prescribed the Tina combo when you just want the pain to be over. You are about done with the nutty, even though it was supposed to be over months ago, and your instinct for independence needs a shot in the arm. Watch Angela Bassett play Tina finding that fire within her to go from her lowest to being Tina freaking Turner. She tells a divorce judge that she doesn't need anything else but freedom and her name. I'll give up all that other stuff. But only if I get to keep my name, she says defiantly. I've worked too hard for it, Your Honor. Cut to me watching it for the 15th time, screaming, God damn it, give me my name. I just want my name. When I had my divorce, I went back and watched Tina. I still had my name. I'm making a lot of jokes to cheer you up, but take this seriously. If you are feeling humiliated and broken by the weight of pain over someone trifling, be Tina. Let yourself be forged in this fire. I, for one, started my adolescence wanting to be Molly Ringwald, but I spent my 20s wanting to be Tina Turner. As for that craziness I felt, one day I woke up and I just didn't feel it anymore. It left. It took time, but it left. It was as if the crazy was a gas bubble. You're just really uncomfortable, and the very core of your body, your stomach and chest, hurts. And then you fart or drop a deuce and the pain leaves you. I promise you, it gets better. You will fart your way to healing. I swear. Pro tip. Cushion the blow with someone else's body. It's always beneficial in a breakup to have somebody else lined up. I really like to move right in and have a plan B, C, D, and E in place before plan A has expired. As you go about this, your best game is honesty. Tell plan B exactly where your head is at. Do you want to be here? Yay or nay? I don't even say, this is a rebound. Don't even put that much weight on it. It's just fun. Tell them it's like hooking up with someone on vacation. Staycation sex. It's on them if they think they can change the situation between you to create a lasting arrangement. Let them try, but at least you were very clear about your motivation from the start. As you refocus your energy on someone else's privates, you save yourself the drudgery of going over in your mind what went wrong. Bitch, you know what went wrong. Unless this is your first guy, you're not that clueless. By your early to mid-20s, you've been through this a few times. So you gotta know there's a common denominator in these equations. And it's you. I, like many women, know what the hell is wrong with me. Whether we choose to do something about it remains to be seen. I know a lot of people talk about closure, giving yourself time to mourn. Let's not play these games. I think the whole pussy moratorium thing is just some puritanical garbage to keep women chaste. I see it all the time in Hollywood. After the end of a relationship, an actress or famous woman has to publicly announce that her legs will be closed until further notice, like some exorcist has to come in to flush out the demons from her vagina. Potential suitors, please wait until the little old lady from Poltergeist comes out and says, "This house is clean." You will hear, "You really need to work on yourself before you jump right into something else." Oh, please, who's got that kind of time? I got shit to do, and I'm trying to work. I'm trying to get home to watch Scandal, and I'm trying to get it in. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow, and here I am using this time to work on myself. By the way, you can work on yourself and still have sex with someone at the same time. Or at least around the same time. Your pussy and brain don't have to take turns. Besides, there's a bunch of hours in the day. You can actually get to therapy and go on a date on the same day. Bonus pro tip. Booze pairings to heal heartache. I will keep this short in case you are already reading this book at a bar. There are only two options for drinking your pain away after a breakup. Red wine or tequila. Never mix. Never worry. Choose red wine if you'd like a warm hug and maybe a nap. A Malbec is that slightly bitter pal who rallies to say, "There, there, we'll get through this." A Cabernet is a model of efficiency, drinkable with a high alcohol content. With all its varied flavors, a Pinot is the one who will encourage you to keep a sense of mystery. But if you want to skip all that and just get to the point where you fuck one of his friends, you go tequila all the way. I prescribe straight, no chaser. Either way, first round is on me. Chapter 12 On Mean Women and Good Dogs. One morning in early 2012, I got a call from Essence magazine. They wanted to give me the Fierce and Fearless Award at their pre-Oscar luncheon in February. I had to give a speech, which I figured would last about 30 seconds. "Thank you," I'd say. "Yay, women." Then they said I would have 5 minutes. "Whoa," I thought. "If you give us your speech, we can have it printed," they offered. That made it real. My instinct to protect myself shot up, and I immediately went to standard Hollywood cliche bullshit. I started writing my speech on my laptop, saving the draft as a file titled Fierce and Fearless. For days, I would just look at the words on my computer screen. How was I supposed to be either of those things, I kept asking myself. I was so afraid that if I told the truth, I would face judgment and rejection. "We live in a town that rewards pretending," I typed. And I had been pretending to be fierce and fearless for a very long time. I was a victim masquerading as a survivor. I went to delete those lines, but kept going. I used to revel in gossip and rumors, and I lived for the negativity inflicted upon my sister actresses or anyone I felt whose shine diminished my own. I took joy in people's pain, and I tap danced on their misery. It was the most honest I'd ever been in my life. When the day came, I put on the armor of a green vintage Versace above-the-knee dress, and I took a deep breath as I approached the podium. As I spoke, I felt the room become still. The murmur of chatter and ding of forks against plates stopped as I read my truth.
People began to put arms around each other's shoulders, drawing them closer and crying. I stammered just slightly at one point, and I felt a wave of love come at me. These incredible, fierce women were all listening, pulling for me. Oprah Winfrey was there, her mouth wide open. Her seatmate, Ayanla Van Zant, reached over to close her mouth for her. I had never heard anyone be that honest in public or private, Oprah said, about the competition and fierce drive to be seen and succeed in Hollywood. To be seen. Leave it to Oprah to get to the heart of the matter. I was desperate just to be seen. I was afraid of anybody else getting attention, because there's only so much to go around. With Oprah's benediction, people started acting like I was the Messiah and I would lead Hollywood's actresses to the promised land of mutual love. I wasn't ready. I'm still in my own shit, I said. And I really was. I had only recently found the courage to get up on that dais and be honest. I had been hiding, sometimes literally. I am someone who physically hides when I am feeling, let's say, stressed in a situation. Behind a garbage can, behind a tree. If I am somewhere and get an attack of the feels, I look for the nearest place to stash myself. I'm the Where's Waldo of emotional availability. There was a particular moment in my life when I found myself hiding under my bed. I was in my early 30s, and my life was a disappointment. My divorce was final, and I decided my career was over because a show I had a lot of hopes for was canceled. I slipped off my bed, looked underneath, and thought, well, that looks cozy. So I scooted myself in, intending to stay there, oh, I don't know, forever. My dog, Bubba Sparks, came into the bedroom to investigate my disappearance. Bubba was a huge dog, about 130 pounds of Mastiff American Bulldog mix, but he was determined to do a marine crawl under that bed to get to me. His path to me was precise, like a longtime soldier carrying out a mission. We did have history. We had found each other in the middle of the night while I was shooting Cradle to the Grave at Los Alamitos Army Base near Long Beach, California. It was a night shoot, and at 2 a.m., my co-star DMX decided he wanted to buy some dogs. He needed a litter of dogs brought to the set right then. People just stood there, dumbfounded. I said, I think I can help you. So I called my then-husband, Chris, who knew a guy who bred Royal Bandogs, Mastiffs bred specifically with American Bulldogs. So Chris called the breeder, and this man showed up to the set at 3:45 a.m. with laundry baskets full of puppies. There were probably five or six dogs in total, all of them brown, except one little white one. They were all so cute, and DMX picked out two, quickly naming them Pebbles and Bam Bam. You can take one of the dogs, too, the breeder said to me. You got me the sale. They were all adorable, but the little white one with a few brown spots seemed to call to me. I picked him up, round and white like a seal, and looked in his little amber eyes. Aw, you have an outie, I said, rubbing his little stomach. That's actually a hernia, said the breeder. He's the runt. The hernia will either retract as he grows or he'll need surgery. We needed each other. He's the one, I said. I named him Bubba Sparks after the white country rapper, and he became my soulmate and best friend. He could tell when I came home frustrated. He'd stay very chill and wait for me to come around without being pushy or needy. If I had big news, he was hyped about it before I even had a chance to articulate it to him. Whenever I had parties and he had the sense that some plus one might be the least bit shady, he wouldn't let them walk around the house. Bubba never growled at anyone who wasn't foul. He was just super intuitive, which is how he knew to be under the bed. This huge lug of a dog crawled under the bed to look me in the eye. We regarded each other for a long time. Is this what we're doing today? He said with his eyes. Okay, it's cool. I just want to know. Because I'm under here. When I didn't respond, he began to lick my face. It was one of those moments where you just realize, well, this is the most pathetic scene ever. Bubba, I said, I think this is what the lady was talking about. The lady was a trainer and life coach who had been hounding me at events. I had literally run from her at red carpets. It was like she could see through the facade. "When you're ready, call me," she'd say, pointing at me like a black female Tony Robbins. "You've got my number. You'll know when you're ready." I reached up to get my cell from the bed. I had put her in my phone as Coach. "Gabrielle," she answered, like she'd been waiting. "I think this is what you were talking about when you said I'd know when I was ready." We met in a gym on a rainy November day. She immediately put boxing gloves on me. I started punching the heavy bag, going strong to impress her. "What's on your happy list?" Coach asked. "My what?" "You gotta do a happy list," she said. "Tell me the things that make you happy." I stalled, hitting harder. She asked me again, pointedly this time, like a drill sergeant. "What makes you happy?" I had nothing. I couldn't think of a single thing or single recent time I'd even been happy. Right away, I felt like I was failing a test. I started to cry, and my heart raced as my anxiety kicked in. I couldn't even do this right. My arms started to get numb from punching, so I slowed down. "Come on," she yelled. "Give me 3 things and I'll let you stop punching the bag." I kept punching, finally saying through gritted teeth, "Real butter." Punch. "Ground beef." Punch. "What else?" Punch. "Imitation crab," I said. Punch. I stopped, exhausted. Coach was looking at me with a mix of disgust and concern. "Bitch," she said, "did you say imitation crab?" In my mind, it was the best parts of the crab, but so much less expensive. "You don't even love the real thing?" she asked. "Can we just start there? The fact that they're all food items, we'll get to that later. Let's stop here, because there's so much more we gotta get to before we can even think about nutrition." She gave me the homework of writing down 10 things that made me happy. We agreed to meet twice a week. I went home and couldn't get past the 3. Real butter, ground beef, and imitation crab meat. I went back to her with the same 3 things the following week. She shook her head at me again, and that session, we didn't work out at all. We just sat in the gym, and she threw out questions, dissecting the smallest pleasures of life. "Do you like sunsets?" she asked. "Do you like sunrises?" Even that made me cry. I didn't know. I ugly cried. "Sunsets? Do you like crushed ice?" she asked. "Whole cubes." I panicked again, weighing the merits of both. When there's a bowl of ice? I paused. I had something. I like really, really cold Coronas. "That's 5, she shouted. She was the Annie Sullivan to my Helen Keller, helping me make sense of my world. I couldn't think of any more. "You can't even think of 10 things that make you happy," she said. "What made you think you were ready for marriage? How is someone else supposed to make you happy if you don't even know what makes you happy?" We started in November, and by January, I had finally found my 10 things. Bubba was on the list. Before that, I couldn't say he made me happy because he was such a good dog, I didn't think I deserved him. Coach and I started examining that kind of thinking, too, and started unraveling my life decisions from there. One night, I took Coach along with me to a party. By then, I was less guarded with her and feeling bold. We were in a room at the party, and I started holding court, using my well-honed ability to turn a phrase to tear down an actress who wasn't present. It was well-honed, because I used to feel I had to do it for survival, but now it was like I was killing for sport. As I ripped this absent woman to shreds, I felt like I was being fed as these people laughed and looked at me with faces that said, "More, more." When I was done, there was nothing left of my target. "How did that change your life?" Coach asked me after my performance.
Excuse me?
Did you get her guy? She asked. Did you get her job? Is your house bigger now? I looked down at the ground, completely called out.
What positive happened in your life because you tore this woman down? She asked. And by the way, you showed exactly how much power she has over you because you spent an hour talking about her to a room full of people.
I realized what I had been doing. When you're in a place where you don't know what makes you happy, it's really easy to be an asshole. I put other people's pain on my happy list. I went home that night, and sure enough, my house was not bigger for tearing that woman down. Bubba came to greet me, and we sat in the living room.
I'm trying, Bubba, I said. You weren't always perfect either.
Bubba was, in fact, a terror, until he was 2½, a whirling dervish of energy. My husband and I were with him in the park when we realized we needed to have him trained. A little boy was calling to him, so Bubba ran down an incline at full speed. His legs got away from him, and he rolled into the kid like a bowling ball. The kid's mom thought it was funny, thank God, but then, as the boy was on the ground, Bubba sniffed him and then peed on him. The first time we worked with a dog trainer, he bit the trainer, which was a blessing because that led me to trainers at a ranch that bills itself as the Disneyland of dog parks. They helped Bubba become the best dog in the history of dogs. He changed. So could I. After my essence speech, the media latched on to the mean girl narrative of what I was saying. They missed the point because it's not like I was some kid slamming people into lockers or spreading rumors about a sophomore. I was talking about being a woman. It's not like you age out of bullshit. It just sort of shapeshifts. Because I was a mean woman, I can spot them. Game recognizes game, right? You encounter them every day if you work with other people, period. Whether you're a teacher, a lawyer in a large firm, or a stay-at-home mom, there is an epidemic now of people being real when they're being anything but. It's the person who loves being someone who notices every little thing wrong with what you say, do, wear, or think, and has to point it out. Those mean women and mean men affect people's opportunities and experiences at work or with their children. When I see negative comments about me online, if I have time, I will go down the rabbit hole of social media to see how great the life of the troll really is. Because you never know, maybe they're right. Maybe they have something to teach me or for me to aspire to. I've done it countless times. Insta-stalking, Twitter-stalking. Never once have I learned something from someone who talks shit. If anything, it's, baby, you really don't want to put a bullseye on your back. But so many people really love the attention they get by trolling. It's a temporary cure for their invisibility. The problem is, there's always an audience for negativity. There could be someone with a bullhorn screaming, I've got a beautiful script here that gives a deeper insight into the human experience, and few in a crowd would pause. And then someone says, I've got Jennifer Lawrence's nudes, and a line will form. Negativity and the exploitation of other people's pain drive so much of our culture and conversation. I know that, but I can still get caught up in my feelings. Recently, I had an absolute complete meltdown over something said about me online. It was a cast-off of a line, a joke the woman posted to get, oh, the shade, likes, and eyeballs. But I became fixated on it, imagining what I would say to her if she said it to my face, and knowing she never would. I was with a friend when I saw it and held up my phone for her to see the post. I was full of, get this bitch bravado, but she took my forearm and gently lowered it. Looking me in the eye, she said, an empress does not concern herself with the antics of fools. She smiled, so I smiled. That kindness, one empress to another,
one woman to another, released me from the bullshit.
Bubba deserves a coda because he's the one who got me here. He remained a good judge of character to the end. When Dwayne first came around, Bubba was apprehensive. One day, 2 full years into our relationship, the three of us were in the park and Bubba jumped up on the table where Dee was sitting. Bubba looked Dee in the eye, just like he'd done to me that morning under the bed. Then, Bubba leaned in to nuzzle him. He was saying, "I like this guy." From where I'm writing this, I can see Bubba's giant paw print in plaster. Yes, I really am that dog person. When he was 12, he was given a year to live. By the grace of modern medicine and my pocketbook, we were able to keep him alive until he was 13. At one point, we were thinking about getting him a new kidney. You had to agree to adopt the kidney donor dog and commit to flying your sick dog up to UC Davis. Like I said, I'm that dog person. But we decided Bubba was old and it would all be too much to put 2 dogs through. When he finally passed, my whole circle went into mourning. If you knew Bubba, you loved Bubba. When I call upon my ancestors and people who've passed to get me through something, I talk to him too. He saw me at my worst and my meanest, and he loved me anyway. Chapter 13. Warning: Famous vaginas get itchy too. Dwayne and I are alone in the car outside of the Walgreens in Miami. "Just go in there," I say. "Nope." "You know what I use," I say. "You're in and out. You do it." The subject is, of course, tampons, which I do not want to buy. Whenever I am in the feminine care section of any pharmacy, no matter how incognito I go, it's like an alert goes out. "Attention, customers, Gabrielle Union has her period. Go say hi." Because if he goes in, yeah, he gets swarmed, but the response is, "What a catch! He buys his wife tampons." If I go in, whether it's a light day or it seems like I've been shot in my vagina, that intimate knowledge is sought out. Having knowledge about someone tending to her vagina is like sneaking a Playboy. "I saw Gabrielle Union buying tampons!" I'm a bleeding spectacle. So you can imagine how unprepared I was when I suspected I had a yeast infection. 'Cause you know how loaded that is. Women aren't allowed to just get yeast infections as, say, part of the body's natural defense mechanism. We have to have caused it in some way by wearing our underwear too tight, not changing our tampons often enough. Men can have jock itch for days and never once have to explain why. I felt the first twinge while I was on a late-night flight to visit a guy I was dating before I married Dee. Let's call him Bachelor One. B1 was extremely hung, and at the time he was sharing a beach house with his huge penis in Miami. The plan was that I would get to his place Friday night, and he would arrive the next morning. This is also a guy who didn't believe women pooped, so a, "Hey, shucks, I have a yeast infection" conversation was out of the question. "Get thee to a CVS," I told myself upon landing. It was about 1 a.m. by the time I stashed my bags at his place and set out for the 24/7 drugstore on Miami Beach. Here's what's great about a pharmacy by the beach in the middle of the night. Nothing. It's teeming. Full. You think you're going to find it hopping with horny teens buying condoms, but it's a drunk in every aisle, white boys trying to figure out which cold medicines will make them higher, and here and there a crying girl hobbling along on one heel looking for flip-flops. And in this particular outpost, one, Gabrielle Union, trying to score some monistat under cover of night. I marched in, determined to be a grown woman seeing to her over-the-counter vaginal cream needs. I was about 3 steps in when, I swear, every head in the place turned. My eyes darted to a display by the register. "Twizzlers," I said, striding over and picking up that bag like it was just the thing I was after and couldn't believe my luck. The guy at the register was a heavyset 20-something who the managers probably thought looked intimidating enough to work the night shift. "Just these Twizzlers," I said,
scanning the candy display in case I had any other last-minute sugar needs.
Are you... he said.
Yes, I said.
How are you? Do you want a bag?
No, I said. I'm good. Back in my car, I called a girlfriend on the West Coast. She always had an answer for everything.
Listen, I need to figure out a home remedy for a yeast infection.
Cranberry juice, she said, not missing a beat. Dr. Quinn, Beverly Hills medicine woman. Like a boatload.
On it, I replied. I waltzed right back into that CVS, waving hi to my register friend as I pointed to the refrigerated section as if I had suddenly become parched. There were 15-ounce and 64-ounce bottles of Cran Apple, which I thought of as regular and maximum strength. Go big or go home, I said to myself, grabbing the 64 with one hand.
Thirsty, I said to my register friend. I drove back to B1's house, guzzling the cranberry juice the whole way. I still felt that now familiar and becoming more intense by the minute burning, so I called my Dr. Quinn again.
911, what's your emergency? She said.
When will it work? I asked.
You got a low-sugar one, right?
I got Cran Apple.
Gab, that's pure sugar. It will only make it worse.
Why didn't you tell me? I yelled. I just drank a half a gallon of the shit. Malpractice!
I think we need to try yogurt, she said. You got to get some yogurt up in there. It will help.
Stay with me, I said. I ran to B1's fridge and scanned the paltry bachelor contents.
Okay, I yelled, grabbing a Dannon vanilla.
The flower of the vanilla plant beckoned me back to feminine health.
Doctor, I'll call you back, I said.
I wiggled out of my jeans and laid paper towels on the kitchen floor.
Here goes nothing, I thought.
I did my best, slathering the cold yogurt all around my vagina, but I couldn't quite get it inside to where the action needed to be. Still lying on the floor, I reached again for the phone.
I can't get it in, I nearly screamed. It's too thick.
The irony of saying this in the home of Big Dick B1 was not lost on me.
You can't, like, spoon it in there?
No, I said, and I can't make a syringe out of a ballpoint pen. I'm not freaking MacGyver.
She paused, as if she were consulting her witchy book of spells.
You need to make a tampon kind of thing, she said. Suck the yogurt into a straw, insert it in like a tampon, and you can squeeze the yogurt up in there.
I went through every drawer in the kitchen. What grown-up keeps straws? I asked.
I don't know your life, she said.
You now know more than most.
Well, go get one, she said. A big, wide one, like the ones at McDonald's.
I now took my yogurt-covered vagina to the McDonald's by the Delano that was open all night.
Inside, there was a long line of the drunk people who weren't at CVS, the ones who had consumed enough alcohol at 2:30 a.m. to give up on their diets and give in to their cravings for French fries. The Girl Scout in me felt like I had to wait in line and at least buy a drink, but soon enough, people started to recognize me. So I jumped off the line and went right to the straw dispenser. I ripped the paper off and held it to my eye like a pirate with a telescope.
That should do it, I said aloud, turning to see an employee stopping the work of sweeping to stare at me.
Hi, I said, a little too loudly, grabbing a second one to ensure the sterility of this new medical tool. You have a nice night.
While driving, I tried to calm my frayed nerves by imagining what that woman would tell her friends the next day.
Gabrielle Union was in here high as a kite looking for a Coke straw. Miraculously, this line of thinking did little to calm my frayed nerves.
Back at B1's, I learned that sucking yogurt through a straw is a little tougher than you'd think. But I did it. And once again, I lay on the floor to squeeze the yogurt in. Whether it was psychosomatic or just psycho, I immediately felt like it was working. I hit redial.
Is this the Dannon helpline? I asked.
Dannon? She said. I hope you use plain.
Shit, he only had vanilla.
Christ, she said, laughing.
What is wrong with you?
That, I said, peering down at my yogurt vagina, is a very fair question. The absurdity of the whole night washed over me, and I finally laughed. I was so scared of being judged for being a woman with a yeast infection that I was willing to put myself through any number of humiliations. I waltzed into a CVS twice and never left with what I needed. I stole a straw from McDonald's in the middle of the night, all to avoid my register friend knowing. I resolved that that would be the last night I found myself lying on some guy's kitchen floor shoving yogurt up my hoo-ha. I would live a more authentic life. To a point. B1 rolled up the next morning and he greeted me with a kiss. I ate your yogurt, I blurted out, trying very hard to seem not at all suspicious. Okay, he said. I ate it, I said. Just ate it. He looked at me like I was crazy, which I was. I mean, what else does one do with yogurt? Chapter 14. Grown-Ass Woman Blues. We are the ladies who lunch. I have two girlfriends around my age, Michelle and Gwyn, who I meet every few months or so for lunch when I'm in Los Angeles. We are grown-ass women, and we are the only ones who understand each other's grown-ass problems. I apologize in advance for looking like a robot, I said when I came to the table at our last gathering. I threw my neck out dancing. How? Asked Gwyn. I tried to whip my hair back. You see, grown-ass problems. At least you're having fun, Michelle said, with Gwyn silently nodding. They are both single. Gwyn, newly so, after a 12-year marriage. Michelle is awesome, but she never found anyone. That's the word she uses. Anyone. Not even the right guy. She is fun and smart and pretty, and she told me she feels invisible when she goes out. She sees what happens to the women her age who fight against invisibility to try to stand out. The ones who raid their daughter's closets or the ones who try so hard to lead a boisterous, Real Housewives camera-ready life with a steady supply of booze. They at least draw attention, if fleeting, but Michelle doesn't want that. She's stuck because if she does what comes natural to her and keeps it low-key, guys won't even notice her. But if she shows she wants a relationship, men will flee. I have to act like I don't want it, she told me, and then act surprised when it doesn't happen. Meanwhile, Gwyn is hot as hell and knows it. She got out of her marriage and went right to the bars. But that doesn't mean the puzzle isn't complicated for her as well. The men our age won't look at me, she said, and I'm this weird science experiment for younger guys chasing older pussy. Single or partnered, successful or striving, we grown-ass women of the world share the feeling that we're all in an experiment that no one is particularly interested in watching except us. I see us all grasping at the straws of staying present in our lives and families and careers. Who knows how we will fare? I can only speak to my experience, so that is what I will do. To wit, can an actress age in Hollywood and continue to work? All previous research has shown the answer to be a hearty no. But it seems for my peers that so far we are working way more than we did in our 20s. But it's the opposite for my non-actor friends as they get older. Their competition for new jobs is younger people who make less and don't have families that they have to take off for. Oh shit, they say. We're those people that we pushed out. Women are told to lean in. Yeah, right. Lean in so I can push you over. At lunch, Michelle told us about the new black at her company. She's young and dope, she said, and she's talking to me about dating. I'm like, fuck you and your dating problems. You're me 20 years ago when I used to get dick. We all nodded, except for me, on account of my neck. I kind of moved forward. I have no patience for her, she said. That's because even though there are all these things that are supposed to be marked against her, said Gwyn, her skin color, the fact that she's a woman. None of that matters next to the fact that you're older. She gets your spot. Yeah,
I said, swiveling my whole body to look at Michelle. But who better to help her navigate that than you? I'm not training the competition to do my job, said Michelle. Would you? No. And I thought about my own hypocrisy. Just the night before, I had attended a pre-Oscar cocktail party for women in film. There, I had met a young actor named Ryan Destiny. She had appeared in the Lee Daniels series Star. I had heard that she looked like me. I saw her in person, and she looks like I literally gave birth to her. Gab 2.0, only better. Oh my God, she said. I'm finally meeting you. This is so amazing. What are you, 12? 22. Shit. I admire you so much, she said. If you could mentor me... Bitch, fuck you, I thought. You want me to mentor you? The press is literally calling you the next Gabrielle Union. Except she can sing and dance. I smiled and the photographers came over. They needed to document this moment of, look who's old. And I get it, because I have a reputation for never aging. And God, do I love that rep. But as the flashbulbs went off, I was suddenly terrified that the ruse would be up. Dorian Gray turning to dust as she's photographed next to someone called the next Gabrielle Union. Looking at Michelle and Gwen, I remembered not just the fear of suddenly looking decrepit next to this young woman, but the wave of panic that if I imparted my knowledge, I would lose in some kind of way. Would I be aiding and abetting myself into forced retirement and exile by helping this drop-dead gorgeous woman? A better, hotter, more talented version of me 25 years ago? To be the women my friends and I are supposed to be, we are supposed to support the women coming up behind us. It's just hard to do that happily when you're finally at the table and you feel any moment someone's going to come up, tap your shoulder, and say, I think you're in my seat. It took me a long time to get that seat, goddammit. I'm not ready to move over just yet. This fear resonates through every industry. For my friends in corporate America, there's a reasonable fear about mentoring young women to be their best selves if that means they could take your job. Younger women are literally dangled in front of their older peers as a you-better-act-right stick to keep older, more experienced women in line. Because we've all seen a pal replaced for a younger, cheaper model with lower expectations and more free time for overtime or courting clients. Modern business is set up to squeeze out women who want it all, which is mostly just code for demanding equal pay for equal work. But the more empowered women in the workforce, the better. The more that women mentor women, the stronger our answer is to the old boys network that we've been left out of. We can't afford to leave any woman behind. We need every woman on the front lines lifting each other up for the good of all of us, and the women who come behind us. It's tough to get past my own fears, so I have to remind myself that this is an experiment to boldly go where no grown-ass woman has gone before. When we refuse to be exiled to the shadows as we mature, we get to be leaders who choose how we treat other women. If I don't support and mentor someone like Ryan, that's working from a place of fear. And if I put my foot on a rising star, that's perpetuating a cycle that will keep us all weak. The actresses in the generation before mine were well aware of their expiration dates, and they furiously tried to beat the clock before Hollywood had decided their milk had gone bad. Yes, there were some supremely catty women in Hollywood who actively spread rumors about younger stars so that they could stay working longer. But there were also way more amazing women who thought big picture. They trusted that if they uplifted each other, in 20 years, there might just be more work to go around. Women like Regina King, Tashina Arnold, Tisha Campbell-Martin, and Jennifer Lewis went out of their way to mentor and educate the next generation. That empowerment is why we have Taraji P. Henson, Kerry Washington, Viola Davis, Sanaa Lathan, and more starring in TV shows and producing films. That creates yet more work for the next woman up. That's what can happen when we mentor and empower. That's what happens when we realize that any joy we find in the next woman's pain or struggle is just a reflection of our own pain. See how hard this is? Do you appreciate how difficult this is? Instead, I want to heal her and me.
Christ. First a stiff neck, and then I have to have this moral code?
Nobody said being a grown-ass woman was easy.
Chapter 15. Get out of my pussy. I decided to finally go get this persistent pain in my hip checked. And my doctor in Miami, who happens to be a friend's dad and one of the world's leading neurosurgeons, told me to go for an MRI and x-ray at the hospital. Coincidentally, another fake round of Gab's knocked up stories was making the rounds at exactly the same time. The photo evidence was that I'd worn a coat in Toronto at night in winter. For sure, knocked up. So here I am walking into a hospital right in the heart of Miami-Dade County, and everyone's clocking me. By the time I get to the imaging center, I've run through a gauntlet of knowing glances and I see you smiles. I know exactly what all these strangers are thinking. And there, as I am filling out the forms, is the question. Are you pregnant? I check. No. Head to room 2 and wait, says the lady behind the desk. I go in, disrobe, put on the tissue paper thin gown, and sit on the table, tapping my feet on the step. You know how, when you're in the doctor's office, each time the door opens, you think, this is it, and you raise your head expectantly with a half-smile that says, I can make pleasantries, but I will also take your role seriously? This happens a couple of times. The first time, there's a knock on the door, and a nurse walks in. I just want to double-check, she says, studying me. We ask all women this. Are you pregnant? Nope. It was on the form. I marked no. Okay, I just wanted to make sure. Not a minute goes by before a different woman pops her head in. Yeah, okay, so just want to make sure, she says, drawing out the sure as she looks me up and down. You've got no hairpins in your hair, no metal on, your earrings are out. Yes. Are you pregnant? Nope. Not pregnant. Put it on the form. Well, hey, yeah, just making sure. Finally, the x-ray tech arrives, and my hip and I are ready for our MRI close-up. Ah, but my uterus is not done stealing the show, because 2 more women walk in. How many damn people work here? Just want to make sure, says the tall one. You're not pregnant. Now I am just sad. No. The shorter woman pats my leg in a rocking petting motion. I just want to make sure you're not pregnant, she chimes in, because we really need to know, because then I am angry. Nope, not pregnant, I say loudly, my heart beating fast and my arms becoming numb from anger. I filled out the form. You're now the 4th person to ask me. I am not pregnant. I know what the websites say. I'm telling you, I'm not pregnant. If I was, I wouldn't fucking be here. They quickly leave. And I lie there, thinking about how some internet clickbait affected my medical care, thinking about what they will say about that girl Gabrielle Union who came into the office today and is actually such a bitch. When it is over, I do my best not to look at anyone. I keep my head down and put my sunglasses on as protection. I am almost to the door of the waiting room when another patient looks up from her magazine. She smiles and I smile back. You and Wade, she says, have such pretty babies. I am out of the office before the tears come. Yes, Dwayne and I would have such pretty babies. But I have had 8 or 9 miscarriages. In order to tell you the exact number, I would have to get out my medical records.
I'm also not sure what the number is where you start to think I must be nuts to keep trying. I never wanted children before Duane. I was afraid to be attached to a man for life if our relationship didn't work out. After Dee got custody of the three children we raise, I was bursting with joy at every milestone, every basket scored and tough homework assignment completed. I was fulfilled raising children, a joy I never saw coming. Wanting to have babies with Duane was a natural desire built on that joy. Duane wanted children with me for a long time before I was fully on board. For me, it was just a maybe. But one day we were with a friend's daughter and she smiled at me. My ovaries literally hurt. And I knew it was time. For 3 years, my body has been a prisoner of trying to get pregnant. Either been about to go into an IVF cycle, in the middle of an IVF cycle, or coming out of an IVF cycle. I have endured 8 failed IVF cycles with my body constantly full of hormones, and as you've probably figured out by now, yes, I am constantly bloated from these hormones. It also means I have forgotten my normal baseline emotional reaction to any given situation, and have no idea whether it would resemble my I'm-going-to-hop-off-the-roof reaction. For as long as I can remember now, Duane and I have lived in this state of extended expectation. Did it take? Is the embryo normal or abnormal? Will I stay pregnant? We are always in some stage, waiting for some news, some sign that we can move on to the next stage. This child we want to have has been loved even as an idea. Each attempt at IVF is a loving action. So we remain here, bursting with love and ready to do anything to meet the child we've both dreamed of. Many of our friends have had their marriages end with the stress that comes with fertility issues and the accompanying feelings of insecurity and failure, not to mention the testing and retesting, defining and redefining of your identity as a woman. And this whole deal has wreaked havoc on my social life. I now hate going to baby showers, but the invitations are constant. I find myself making up excuses to avoid them. I hate hanging out with mothers who constantly talk about their kids. And what mother doesn't love to talk about her kids? Well, actually, I do have some mom friends who can't stand their kids most of the time. Them, I like. People who know about my fertility issues often hand their babies to me to hold, or text me pictures of babies. To keep your hope alive, they say. Nobody seems to think that's insensitive or maybe hard for me. So no, I will not look at your Instagram if it's full of babies. Though Dee and I did enjoy the video a friend sent of her toddler sitting on the toilet and taking a crap, her face wrinkling with effort, then suddenly melting into surprise and relief. Comic gold. We watched it 76 times. I did force myself to go to one baby shower recently because I knew the woman had struggled with IVF. I wanted a winner's insight. I wanted to know what had pushed her to the finish line. I sat my ass down, she said. I quit my job. And I stayed home and sat my ass down. That's all I focused on. That's all I did. That's all? I wanted to say, you gave up the work that you love? That's all. Unfortunately, I kind of function as a single-income household. I may not support the family I've created with Dee, but I have several households of various family members I am alone responsible for. People assume I have a rich husband who pays for everything, practically giving me a salary. I don't, and I don't want that. So not working is simply not an option for me. And I know it's not an option for many women who want an opportunity to be a parent. It's awesome if that works in your life, and many people have assumed I can go this route. But the bank is weird about wanting their money. Those mortgages don't pay themselves. Maybe not asking my rich husband to pay all my bills makes me selfish and not mother material. But if I did that, I'd already feel like I failed as a mother. During another recent pregnancy rumor, I had to do a press line, which is what you see when a celebrity is talking to a bunch of reporters at an event.